This interview with Gardnell Carter was recorded on June 19, 2021, during the Baltimore Youth Film Arts Workshop, Inside Stories, Perspectives on Incarceration.
The thing of it is, as I'm riding, I'm just looking at all these boarded up houses. One of the restaurants that I used to love to go into was Yellow Bowls that used to be right there on Greenmount Avenue and Preston Street. It just was destroyed. And the further I'm going up, I'm just continuing to see boarded up houses. So now when I get off the bus on North Avenue in Greenmount, I catch the 13. So now as we riding down North Avenue, I'm saying the same thing, so I'm saying to myself, what the hell done happened out here? And then, where did all the people go at? You know, so they was my first two thoughts. And so, when I got to work, I used to just sit around and talk to some of the guys that I was working with because they was free, you know what I mean? And they was telling me about some of the things that was going on and stuff like that. But it was real, real spooky. So when you talk about noises, right, because we not used to the real loud music being played, people, you know, just screaming and hollering and stuff like that. So all that just caught my attention, and I used to turn around and look a lot. You know what I'm saying? And I'm going to tell you the most amazing thing that I seen that really flipped me out is what y'all call catching the hat now. But back in my day, that was called hitchhiking, right? That was a no-no in my time, in my area. Because of Route 66, when they was finding all these people that used to hitchhike dead on the highway. So, you know, for the black community to take that on, that was a phenomenon to me, you know. The other thing of it is just seeing how aggressive women were towards meeting men and stuff like that. So I come from that era of time, you know, courting and building relationship was an art. And, you know, you had to be real skillful and everything. Now I see all that was lost. So I was like, wow, society has definitely changed. And to tell you the truth, I've been home 15 years, right? In prison, when you go to eat, your spoon is your lifeline. If you ain't got that spoon when it comes to leave out that kitchen, you're going on lockup. And then the jail may get shut down until they find that spoon, because they're going to search everywhere. But you'll be on lockup for a while. Till this day, sad to say, I still eat with a spoon. Yeah, I just don't feel comfortable eating with a fork, you know. So it's still some things that still affect us. But a lot of stuff I have, like when I first came home and I went to go take a shower. So one of the things, we make what we call shower bags. We put our soap, our lotion, washcloth, and everything in there. And when you go in the shower, you hang it up, you know what I mean? You take your shower and stuff like that. So you carry this bag around everywhere. And then you got a hanger where you wash your underwear, your t-shirt, and you hang it up. And so when you go back in your cell, you just hang it up. Well, I did that for about a month because I came home and I was living with my sister. You know, I had to break that habit too. You know what I mean? So it was a few things that I had to break. See this, prison isn't a natural habitat for no human being or animal. You know, I mean, I know we have some people like myself that have done some wrong. Hey, Pastor, how you doing? Done some wrong in life, and some of us need to go through there, but it's not a very welcoming spot. It's a very, very dangerous spot. You know, the thing of it is, I guess when I went to prison, I had the opportunity to go to school. I took a couple shots. So I became a licensed plumber while I was in prison. And then when I started getting transferred to different prison, I was a 24-hour plumber on call in prison. I basically used prison to reform myself. But if you're looking for prison to do any kind of reform to any individual, that's not going to happen. The individual has to take that on themselves. It was a place where people could become healthier, clean themselves up and stuff now, but I hear that because, you know, you had access to utilize the weights, run the yard and stuff like that, play basketball. You could play sports and stuff like that to keep you fit and stuff like that. But now they tell me people don't even play sports no more in prison. They barely lift weights, if it's any. They barely working out. A prison became, I think they allowed them to have them PSP players or whatever, and they can trade off the games or whatever it is. So there's no more prison library for people that are incarcerated. I think that's the lost treasure right there. People get incarcerated, they don't have nowhere to go to work on their case. But that leads to no reform at all. Unless you take it on yourself. People become accustomed to just being in there doing their time. I just had a friend of mine, he just was released after doing 39 years. So for the first 30 years of his incarceration, he never worked on his case never tried to get a time back or anything. And it was a few brothers and family members like myself that really encouraged him to start looking at giving his time back because they had started letting lifers out. And he just got out. Just think about, you know, for 30 years, he just accepted the fact that he might never come back home. Doing 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years in prison, you suffer almost the same mental stress, mental health issues as those that have been in a war. Even though we've not been in a war-torn, experiencing bombs and things of that nature, but we experienced the mental anguish, the physical anguish of being in prison. You know, you can't come home and attend to any family member that passes away. I lost all my grandparents and my great aunts and uncles. Even I lost my father before I came home and wasn't able to go out and visit. There was no compassion leave or none of that thing. And the only thing that they do when you do lose a family member, they call you to the major's office and they'll have a pastor talk to you for a minute, but then they allow you to go back to your cell. So you will get some of the compassion from your fellow inmates who know you and know your family and things of that, or who have gotten to know you, will sit down and try to keep you focused. But if you ain't got none of that, you're going to go crazy. Yeah, so you have to hold all your emotions. So the one thing in prison, you cannot allow no one to see your feelings. You have to lock that away in a safe somewhere, you know, because you can't show that. You can't express that because people would take advantage of that. Remember I said you're in a concrete jungle and you're dealing with all kind of different mentalities. And everybody wants to be so hard and they want to survive. So when you're in survival mode, you cannot show them weaknesses. And like I said, it's even worse now because, you know, when I went to prison, we didn't have these different gang populations. I mean, we had a few people that was clicked up, or what you would say you had. I mean, the biggest thing when I went to prison, you had West Baltimore against East Baltimore or Baltimore against D.C. You know what I mean? That was the biggest thing. But now you got all these different gang cultures and organizations that are popping up in prison. So now when you come to prison, you have to choose what affiliation you're going to be with to survive. And if you neutral, you the lone sheep. That doesn't work. And then the sad thing about it, you have so many officers that side with some of the affiliations or the organizations in there because that's how they have to survive as well. Some of them are even members of some of the groups. You know what I mean? So it's even 10 times worse now, you know, because now you got to come in and choose just to survive. Everybody has a prison job. And what a prison job allows you to do, to get out and be a little bit more mobile or free, not isolated to your tail, things like. So like I was saying, I went to school, I took shops so that I could stay busy. So I worked for the maintenance department in prison, in almost every prison I went to, which you was called probably one of the trustee inmates because I carried a toolbox with all the tools. I was responsible for making sure my tools was in there when I returned that toolbox because if I didn't, I would be on lockup for a long time, right? If a screwdriver or a hammer or anything like that got missing. You know, I was responsible for making sure I took care of all my tickets that I got in to do plumbing work. Then I became a gym instructor in the evenings. So I constantly just stayed busy. Instead of the time doing me, I did the time in a constructive manner. The more you stay busy and active, you know what I mean, and then I can get around and I can see other inmates in other housing units or on other tiers or whatever it was, socialize with them a little bit. It allowed you to move and be mobile, you know. So one of the benefits of having a job like that, so with each job in prison, you can earn good time. So in a year, you can earn 2 months good time off of your sentence, right? And they'll keep calculating that up until your expiration date or if you make parole or something like that. So that's the extra incentive for doing work in the prison is earning them good days. We only made 85 cents a day. So you've been in prison, let's say, 10 years with a few guys, and y'all been together throughout your whole time incarcerated, but they may have more time than you. So some of them will get jealous, or I really don't even know what the feeling is, but some of them will try to derail you going home to get you to catch a ticket or something like that, so you can stay there with them because you're leaving the pack. You're always going to have opposition in prison, no matter who you are. People just going to want to try you because now they try to make a name for themselves and stuff like that. So you're always going to get tried in prison. You know, it's how you respond and how you deal with that. Once you have to demonstrate on one person or a few people, a lot of times your name get around the prison as a trustworthy person or a stand-up man, you know what I mean? Then there's almost like hands off. You got to gain that respect in prison. Don't mean that you still won't get tried because you're respected in prison, but people have respect for what you're trying to do, who you are, you know, and things of that nature. Even though I was in prison, I still was a dad. So I stayed in constant contact with my children through letters. So I got good at artistry of making birthday cards and things of this nature, making necklaces and stuff like that. So I always was sending some things out. And then I had my little hustle in prison. I had a way of getting the Muslim fragrances and oils in prison. So I always made money that I could send home and to them to, you know, just to play my part, right? But one of the things I used to always tell, and I still tell people today, before you make any decision in life, evaluate decisions, the pros and cons. If I make this decision, what is it going to do? How is it going to affect my family? Because every decision that you make directly affects you, but indirectly affects people in your family. So make sure that you're making the right decision. And don't make decisions out of frustration or anger, because a lot of times we're going to make the wrong decision when we're in that place right there. So have a calm place. Think about what you want to do. And then when you make that decision, evaluate it. Weigh it. Put it on a scale. If I do this and the outcomes ain't right, what's going to happen? If I don't do this, what is the outcomes and what are the things that's going to happen? And that's what I have been teaching my. I tell anybody that now today, because sometimes we're in such a fast track society. We really, really don't take the time out to sit down and evaluate our choices. Yes, I could have. I should have. Because when I look at it, once I did what I did, it ain't benefit my family or myself. You know, over a few dollars. It ain't help my kids get raised. It ain't help my family pay no bills or nothing like that. So at the end of the day, it was a senseless, worthless decision. But like I said, I don't weigh too heavy on that, because the outcome was it helped to change my life. Because if I wouldn't have went to prison, I might have would have been in the morgue sooner or later. I've been home 15 years, right? So I came home in 2007. And I actually had, so I was still working for the home improvement company. But what the brother did, I ended up buying me a piece of pickup truck. He contracted me to do the plumbing in all his houses, right? So I was doing this, and then an opportunity came when the Safe Streets program first got implemented in Baltimore City. And I interviewed for it. And like I said, I was one of the first seven guys that got hired for this. I have been with Safe Streets Baltimore since 2007. I was the director, so I held every position in Safe Streets Baltimore and became a director of the Safe Streets site down on Monument Street, McElderry Park. Last year, I was elevated, so now I am in the mayor's office working for the Safe Streets Baltimore as the community liaison. Dante Barksdale?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
They just did a dedication. I'm finding out today. They just did a dedication and a name. They named the street where he got killed after him. People are always jealous. You know, Dante worked with me for 13 years. I actually met Dante in prison in 1992. So
okay.
Me and Dante, that's how we developed our friendship. But we worked side by side every day. The thing of it is that when we put our life on the line, because we deal with gun violence and the gang culture, one of the mission of Safe Streets is to reduce shootings and homicides, in the areas that our safe street sites are set up. So we have been doing this for the longest time. So Dante actually was made a hero and a martyr for doing what he believed, what he loved doing. We're subject to this at any time. Any one of us is subject because we don't have no guns. We don't have no bulletproof vests. And like I said, out here trying to talk to people to get them to calm down, to help them change their thinking, their morals, helping them to, you know, put the gun down. It is a very, very, very challenging job. The most difficult part, building them relationships with the shooters. We came from that criminal element. So, you know, in our lifestyle, we didn't fear anything then, and we pretty much don't fear anything now. It's just that we used that attitude and that mentality to try to solve problems in society then instead of creating the problems. We have reached and touched a lot of people, have changed some lives, but, you know, one of the things me and a guy was just talking about just recently, because one of our slogans is that homicides is not normal. Okay, it wasn't normal when my early childhood, right, before our young people and young women that are out here living right now, this is a normal way of living for them because they was raised in a time when Baltimore was just seeing 250 to 300 something murders every year, shootings taking place or people being killed in their neighborhoods every day, the drugs, the robberies and things like. So this is a normal way of living for them, and their living is surviving every day to navigate through what they're living through. The story should be transformation. Anybody can transform. I always use this metaphor that one of the writers that I like is Dr. Naeem Akbar. He wrote a few books, The Community Itself, From Male to Manhood. And in this thing, he talks about transformation of how some things. So I look at myself and how society takes in view, because some people look at a caterpillar and thinking that it's a despicable creature on the earth, right? A lot of people like to stomp on them, or kick them away and things of that nature. So I put myself in that state of being this caterpillar. But once I went into the cocoon, I used the prison as the cocoon, you know, where I had the opportunity to get my GED, to build myself up, to try to eradicate some things from my life, to take on some new insights, some new learning. And you know, when the caterpillar comes out of the cocoon, it becomes what? A butterfly, which is beautiful to society and some people, right? So I always use that, you know what I mean, because that seemed to have been what my life did. You know, I transformed my life into the individual that I am now. And I would love to continue to help transform many of our young people. And it seems like today, even some of our older people, to become this butterfly. The one thing I learned, man, is human life is sacred and everybody has a right to live their life. Yeah, because, you know, most of us that have been incarcerated, that have came home to become productive members of society, to try to help change some of our young people in society, getting involved in different groups and even creating different organizations to help bring this gun violence and stuff down. They have all been caterpillars and came out butterflies. Yeah, they have translated that some of them became worse because they allowed their anger to proceed and take control. You know, the one thing I also say that I also was involved with therapy while I was in prison. I had the opportunity to be incarcerated down Patuxent, which at that time was a very therapeutic program. So I know therapy helped me a lot as well. And I believe a lot of individuals that have been locked up a long time, two things should happen with them. They should not be released straight out on the street. They should at least be allowed to go through a halfway system for at least 8 months to a year. And in there, that's when all the wraparound service should be for him. The therapy, rebuilding and introducing themselves to their families, all them things, because you think about some people that's been locked up so long that don't have no one out here when they get released. What are they to do? They are lost. The society that they left is not the same when they coming home. Some of the neighborhoods are gone where some of them grew up at. I believe that everyone should get that kind of help before they touch down on these streets. Because you're going to need therapy. You're going to need that mental health services to help you to navigate through society. You've been locked up a long time. If you don't have a good support system, where did the love go? Baltimore was once a loving town. And you could see it. People in so much survival mode, they don't have time to love. And I'm talking about love. I'm talking about demonstrating real love. Some people haven't really experienced real love. That's why some of them are joining different organizations or behaving the way that they are, because they crying out for it. But you think about the average 20-year-old. For 20 years, you know, our society, as Fox 45 call it now, city in crisis. We've been in crisis mode for too long. There's no love in the school system. You know, as these kids are coming up, this is where the first signs of children needing help is in elementary school, where the wraparound services should be helped. They should be helping to support families and build families up so that our children can be nurtured. We have people living in neighborhoods that don't even speak to their neighbors, don't even know their neighbors. When I was coming up, our neighbors knew almost damn near everybody in the community, even damaged community policing. You know, the police officers that worked in our neighborhoods knew all the families. There was something that was lost. And we got to find a way to get that back. I think one of the one things of it is that, you know, in rebuilding the families, we got to take the surrogate parents. And what I mean by the surrogate parents, I mean the phones and the iPads away from children and give children that quality time that they need from a loving human being and not a machine. Because the machine is giving them so much information and so much access that they can't properly process what is taking place. Wrong has become right today, and right has become wrong. We all think we know a lot, but you know what I mean? As human beings, we're going to go through life still learning. I'm always open to learning. You know, one of the things I would say in synopsis, as our young fellows that are on this line, sisters and brothers, to put together what we want to call a youth council of helping our older folks learn to strategize and properly develop relationships with young people, because there is a generational gap in language, and we wanna help break the fear of our older people even becoming involved in young people. Because there's a big miscommunication there. They ain't lost. They just need some guidance. They're not lost. Like I said, they got too much stuff going on with them. This is a fast-paced world. You know what I mean? Everything is so fast-paced. Even when you're driving, you see people don't even have patience no more to wait at a light. They'll go through the red light. You know, where did our patience go in society? What is the rush? What are we rushing to? Everything is just so fast-paced. And so when we look at the information that we receive, you know, you at the touch of your hand, you have the world exposed to you. That is too much. That is too much, and it's too much to process. I'm still trying to navigate learning how to work my phone and working on a computer, because I didn't come up in the computer era. You know what I'm saying? So that is one place we can start. How can we teach and educate our seniors on social media, on computer literacy, and things of that nature? I hope this can benefit a lot of people and educate people, you know, because we need it. Our society need everyone, all hands on deck, to get out and help to solve the problems that our city is facing, because we can make Baltimore a beautiful place again.
one day. And I told him that a group of us would like to start a program in the course while we're here to talk to the first time youth offenders that's coming here. Because, like I said, I was nervous, I was scared. People was tricking you when you went in there. People was raping you and molesting you and things of that nature. And this stuff was still going on. And I explained that to the warden that, these guys coming here with nothing, and they asked to bar things, not understanding, the rules and regulations of this different world, of being in a different world other than being outside in another world, and a lot of times they would fall in the trap. So they allow us to start, this Youth Act program that while we was in there. I started a new job. Once I got out of that, I went into this other job called MCI program. It's like where you make the most money in the program, but we was printing up license stickers, yearly stickers and stuff like that to go on to cars and stuff like that for motor vehicle, they didn't contracts. So we was doing that. And I learned to do that. One of the things I learned is how to run a printing press. It's called the ABJ printing press and stuff like that. So I learned to do that with that. You have to choose and decide what you want to do with your time. You have to sit back and ask yourself, do you want to further go down the rabbit hole, or do you want to change, your way of life, And it's real hard to do that because I say, like, you're in a different world and there's so much going on around you and your mentality change, while you're there. So I made the choice, to try to say, I'm going to do something with my life because I don't even know if I'm going to make it home or not with a 50-year sentence. It's like having a life debt. It makes you feel good. It's more than making you feel good because first, let me get back to this. And I don't want to be redundant. I'm Muslim, and it gives you a different perspective on how to look at life, and how to look at another human being, whether you Muslim, Jew, Christian, whatever, atheist, whatever. It gives you a different perspective to look at life and how to respect it, So what you say, you have to be that. You couldn't just say something to somebody in there and not allow it to be your character. So it made me feel good that the things that I was saying to the guys that was coming in, that some of them was older than me, some of them wasn't older than me. It made me feel good to say the things that I was saying to them because I had to be what I was saying. My model had to be that inside of the jail. When we stepped out of this room and going back into, the jail system, you have to be that. And them guys looked at you real close, and they draw closer to you because they felt a sense of protection that everybody looked for when you go in there. Even the strongest guys, like when I talk about Little Melvin, Sim Charles, Stakem and stuff like that, even the guy from The Wire, they're my closest friends, Chris Warren and all of them, Bodie, all of them, they're my closest friends. These are guys I come up with. Even us, we cry. We feel a sense of abandonment. We feel like, we left alone and there's nobody there for us. So you have to, pull yourself together and you have to make a serious decision. Now, I didn't make this decision when I first went in there. I still had a street mentality. It was, to me, it was kill or be killed. Do what you had to do. You have to be there first, to find out, how do I deal with this world in here? How do I deal with all these ills that I heard about what's going on in here? You know what I mean? And again, I've seen guys trick dudes out of their butt. I've seen dudes trick, and some of them was the best of friends. I heard a dude, and he was talking about paying off his bill. He said he had another court to go through. He had already had a 30-year sentence. It was a white guy. And he said he don't think he can handle another, some more time. And it was a commissary day. And everybody was going up to the chow when he was coming back from commissary. He said, I'm going to pay all y'all off that I owe y'all. He said, y'all can take this right here. He said, the rest of y'all, when y'all come back, it'll be in my cell. Now, his cell was next door to me. And again, I worked in an MCI shop. So that's the best job you can get in the system. I came down to go to commissary just to put my stuff in my cell and then go back to work. So I didn't go to chow that day. So I heard something, and I had made my salat because my prayer came in. But I heard something kicking on the wall real hard, kicking on the wall real, real hard and stuff. I knocked on the wall, right? And I said, boy, you all right over there? And it wouldn't, never said nothing. So when they came back from chow, he had hung himself. He had hung himself. You open up all the doors when you come back from chow, but you got to get in your cell. And I stepped out there to look at him and make sure he was all right. But he had hung himself, you know. And it messed me up real bad, you know, because that wasn't the first hanging I saw. But he was actually a good dude, you know. I mean, we made mistakes, stuff like that, you know, but he was actually a good dude. You know, that wasn't the only hanging I saw. I saw a lot. You know, being in prison for 30 years, you see a lot. I'm going to give you two, and I'm going to try to make it as brief as possible. I'm gonna give you two of the experiences that I saw. Well, I'm gonna give you three, and I'm gonna make them real brief. Young guy, younger than me at the time, I had grown a little older then. I probably was in my mid-20s, maybe late-20s. Was on the phone talking to his young lady, telling her that, you know, don't leave, hold on. You know, I got a kid, but you say I'm going back to court. He said. And the judge talking about taking most of my time back. That means I would only have to do a year. You can hear him because he's talking real loud. And at this time, they had put phones on the tears. And he was talking real loud and stuff like that. And he was like, don't leave me. And started crying and stuff like that. And the officer, you know, told him he had to hold it down because he was loud and talking to his girl. So she must have hung up on him because he kept saying, you dead. And he tried to call back, and she wouldn't accept the call. He asked the officer to let him lock in and stuff. And he went and locked in. And about a half an hour, maybe to an hour later, you know, the tier he was on was a traffic tier. And what that means, you had to come through his tier to get to other tiers, you know. And one of his friends was coming up this through the tier to go to his cell. I mean, to go to his tier, looked in his cell, and he had hung himself. He was hanging from the bars, and when the officer opened up the grill, everybody ran down to his cell, you know, and they were telling the officer, open the door so we can grab and try to put him up to see if he was still living. Mm-hmm. But the officer, you can't do that. You got to leave the scene exactly the way it is, you yeah. know. And the officer wouldn't open the door. He wouldn't even go in there and do it until the warden came up and nurses from the infirmary came up. So we felt that sense of betrayal, you know, knowing that the system didn't have our best interests at heart. When gangs started getting popular in the jail, this guy, he, you know, his family was real supportive of him. So, and we get packages. We had package months and all that type of stuff. You know, and this guy, he would take certain guys and say, let me get a package in your name that wasn't getting packaged. He said, I'll get my mother to buy you a couple pair of jeans and I'll get my mother to buy you some tennis, you know, because he wanted to get have a lot of clothes. Mm-hmm. So this particular dude, I knew the dude too, come out of Lexington Terrace. You know, he was in the game, Black Gorilla, whatever they call him. What's the name?
Family.
Exactly.
BFG, Black Gorilla right. Family.
That's right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And they went to him to lean on him and tell him to go get us some of this. And he told me, he said, man, you must be crazy. I'm not getting you anything. He said, all right, so I'm not, you know, scared of that. So we went in the yard that evening. And in jail, you can tell when something can happen because you feel that all around you, so you know it. You know, you feel that vibe going around you, and everybody back is to the wall. You know, so I walk out in the yard, and one of the guys say, you know, I used to like to run the yard. He used to say, Basim, hold on, man. He said, something great happened. And lo and behold, while I can turn around, you can hear a bat cracking. The dude hit the dude with the bat in the head and cracked his skull. Mm-hmm. He died. He died. They sent in an ambulance to lift him up out of there, but the guy died. We had to go in this place called the Annex, so they moved a lot of us off the tier because off of certain tiers because asbestos was all through the tier, and the fungus and stuff was going up the wall. So while they was working on it and closed down the tier, they sent us in this place called the Annex. It's like a dorm. Mm-hmm. You got three parts to this dorm. You know, so we had one tier in this dorm, one tier in that dorm, one tier. And you can interact with each other and stuff like that. This guy that I know that come out of Murphy Holmes, and another guy that came out of another part of Murphy Holmes, was there. And the older guy, and the guy was real small. He was leaning on the younger guy. He was always take his commissary, always go through his packets and stuff like that. And the younger guy would always report to the officers what the guy was doing. And he wanted to be moved from the tier or moved out of jail. And they would just discount it and throw it away and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So when they moved us down in the annex, and they had a gym period, and a guy told him, and it was a commissary day, and he told me, he said, when I come back, excuse my language, he said, my commissary shit better be on my bed. The young guy said, I'm tired of this, man. I'm not going to allow you to do this to me anymore. This is the last time. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing it. So on the way, when they came back from gym, we get like an hour and maybe 20 minutes to a half an hour in gym. You know, when they came back from gym, he come in there. He called himself being bad. He walked straight to the young guy. And the young guy pulled out an ice pick and stuck him right in his chest. And he left it in his chest. And the dude grabbed his chest and turned around. And what you call, what we got, where officers sit up in the station, we call it the bubble. He tried to walk to the bubble, and before he got to the bubble, he fell. And that's where he died. You know, so, you know, a lot of stuff in prison, yeah, you see. It's like a lot of yes, infection. And you have to you have to mold your life around that, because you don't never know when it's going to be someone to challenge you. One thing my mother told me when she put me out, right, she used to always, you know, still be there for me, but she told me, don't you ever think you bad, because there's someone badder than you. And they will always challenge you because they want to be the most bad one. She said, but always be serious and a man of your word. And I stuck with that. It stuck with me to the day. I'm a serious brother. And I take things real serious. And I try to be a man of my word. And if things change, I go to the person and say, look, I have to do something else. This is what happened. Now, can you bear with me? Or let's just, you know, resolve the issue. You know, and I remember that. And it makes me a better man. Having a strike against you, you know, it always fall in a place where opportunities are lacking, and you are not, you know, given the, you know, the best of the choices that come a person's way. But you have to realize that you put yourself in this position, and you have to make something happen for yourself. You know, society, to me, in a lot of ways, haven't gotten better. It got some ways worse than it was when I went into society, because, you know, you did, like, you know, Brother Greg said, you had a more conscious out here on the streets when I went in. You know, men would be men, and they would stick, you know, they lived it by principles and standards and stuff like that. You know, today, youth doesn't live by certain standards or morals and stuff like that. Even when you go into going into a company or a corporation and trying to get a job. You know, when I first came home, I went to this welding company, and my credentials was better than the guy that was before me and after me. And when I went into an interview, she asked me, was I ever incarcerated? I started to lie because I know is a window that you have from 5 to 7 years that they can ask you about your incarceration or put on your application. And I didn't put it on there. And when she went down the application, she asked me, you know, was you ever incarcerated? And I paused. And I was asking myself in my mind, you know, should I tell her the truth or should I lie? You know, and I said, I'm going to tell her the truth because this would be the best way of me getting something, you know, with my belief in God and everything and stuff like that. So I told her, I said, yes, I was incarcerated before. I said, but it'd been a long time ago. It was a while ago. I said, it was back in 1985. I said, I haven't been to prison since then. And then she said, would you mind expounding on what you was incarcerated for? And it kind of, I kind of knew then, right then and there, that I was going to be a scratch from this list, right? And I told her, I said, is that a requirement? Do I have to do it? She said, no, you don't have to do it. She said, but I prefer you do it. Okay. I told her, I said, okay, well, I was young. I said, I come out of a drug-ridden area. Some of us would call it probably ghetto and things of that nature. I say, but it was, an area where you grew up and you had to make certain choices. I said, when I was young, I made the wrong choice. I said, I got in a situation where some guys kind of tried to rob me, and I had a gun on me. And I shot one of the guys, and he died. And she said, all right, I don't need to hear no more. But I knew right then and there that society wasn't going to play fair with me, you know, and that I would have to make my own way. But I had to understand, too, on the other side of that coin, no one did this to me but me, you know. So I had to find somewhere to keep trying to put this bitterness that I had with society about me being in incarceration in a place where it wouldn't affect me of doing what I needed to be done, you know. So, yeah, no. I think society plays for it. And sometimes it does. Yes, I appreciate that. I appreciate that, Anna. And, you know, it was a blessing to me. You know, and just to piggyback from what you said, right, in terms of strength, a lot of people say to me, right, Fasim, that's my Muslim man. They say, Fasim, tell me the truth. You did 30 years straight. I say, yeah. I say, man, you're not demented. You're not crazy. Nothing like that stuff. I said, I'm blessed by God. I say, so if you call that crazy, then I'm crazy. I said, but no, I'm not crazy. Do I have my moments of psychological effects? I said, yeah, I had them. I said, but everybody has them. You know, I said, but I'm not crazy. I trusted God while I was there, and God brought me through. But when I went to prison, you know, I had a prison experience where I went to a Christian meeting and they was talking about other religious groups on how, you know, if you don't accept Christ, you're going to hell, and you and they this and they that, you know, some of them are nationalists and all. Now I said to them, this is before I caught my 50-year sentence. I say, why are we talking about other groups? Let's talk about what God can do for us. Because I'm scared, because I went in there, my papers, they give you a true bill when you have a murder. Had first degree on there, murder. You don't get the rest of the degrees until you go into court. You know, like first degree, second degree, manslaughter, something like that, or not guilty. You know, so I said, why do we keep talking about these people? Let's talk about what God going to do for us and what we need to do to change. I don't want to hear that in the outside coordinating them. And I hear the group say, well, if you don't want to hear this, you can leave, right? And I left. And I had already knew two older guys that was in Islam. Asked me, well, I thought you was at your meeting. I said, nah, I just went through something, you know, stuff like that. So they said, well, you're welcome to come to a Talim service, which is a speaking gathering when you go to the Muslim thing. And it made me open my heart to look at other religions. And I seen Islam, I found Islam was the best thing for me. You know, it opened my mind. You know, it gave me a different perspective about people and the world, you know. And it just went from there, you know, just went from there. But I try not to push it on other people, because they are who they are, regardless of what it is. You know, I just, you know, leave it to me. And when somebody asks me, then I explain it to them. I would love to do this again whenever you need me. I would love to give back because there's so much to what I have to say in terms of me, that transition from being my first incarceration into my second, you know, and yes, the things that affected me in terms of my second incarceration. So I would love to do this again because I feel like I'm giving back.